Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The anniversary this past week of the Blitzkrieg beginning of World War II on September 1st, 1939, combined with the 16th anniversary of 9/11, 4 days hence, might act as a wake-up clarion to the threat of a nuclear war on the visible horizon. These anniversaries also point to a distal laxity that seems to have replaced the palpable anxiety that permeated human society throughout the half-century of the Cold War. Realistic perception of nuclear terror has dissolved into vapid heedlessness. Nuclear bullies openly threaten war. Although we regard whoever attacked the home country without warning on September 11, 2001 as cowardly terrorists, they undoubtedly thought themselves heroic Davids standing up against that gigantic juggernaut of Goliath to revenge contemporary and historical, and not surprisingly, biblically theocratic grievances. They struck not only at the centers of U.S. economic and military power, they were also striking at the great site of American domination of world civilization. So we have two warring sides that zealously claim God and right on their side. One with an arsenal capable of atomizing the world to oblivion, the other armed with comparatively inferior weapons, yet with imaginatively destructive intentions of their use. They have shown worldwide versatility, capable of attacking anywhere with messianic fury and calculated homicidal suicide. Human civilization is on the brink of something dire and awesome. It stares into a vortex that might realistically obliterate it. Already the prospect for nuclear war is invoked. The final conflict predicted for millennia and possibly encouraged by millenarians who evoke world apocalypse by implements of doom that ancient prophecies were only able to incite. Palestine, Israel is a focal point of the vortex. It is where two very different peoples clash over ancestral land each disputably claims undisputably, exacerbating every other conflict between Islam and the West, which might be the real prophesized Armageddon. This is the root of the problem that prevents a truly world civilization, which has been a long-held dream, at least for dreamers, philosophers, and humanitarians weary of the interminable wars between tribes, cultures, religions, and nations. Here is the seemingly irresolvable problem that threatens humanity with possible annihilation. Here, the best and worst of humanity are evident on both sides and clash head-on. It is only a matter of time before humanity reactivates the hobgoblin of nuclear holocaust and blasts ourselves out of the universe, as we almost did over a half-century span, developing arsenals so huge that nearly three decades after the Cold War, more than enough nuclear weapons remain stockpiled to blow the planet to smithereens several times over. The grim visions of humanity's future, if it continues to make war upon itself on a small, already overcrowded world on which the infection of violence and rabid bigotry can spread faster than other diseases. Nuclear power, the fortress of nationalism, renders a nation state as extinct as dinosaurs. True, the human species will die out someday, or it might evolve beyond anything recognizable as human. Or is it hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past, and thus patently self-destructs? It would be a grotesque irony that humanity perishes because it is unable to resolve conflicts from its earliest history. The irresponsible rapaciousness that underlies humanity and fuels the omnipotence of those who would be masters of the planet, galaxy, or cosmos might very well eradicate the species and its home planet in a biocidal equivalent of thermonuclear war in the eternal death brawl for supremacy. Then again, we might culturally self-destruct through a fabulously modern way of virtuality by cyber war, breaking all the interconnections with which we are increasingly dependent, eradicating our multicultural world, one-world civilization by the very modem that is creating it. Maybe this new century Earth will be hit by a doomsday rock bursting from outer space, as was erroneously, we should hope it is an error, predicted in the final years of the last century to knock us off orbit in the year 2028. Nuclear terrorism practiced by Trump and his North Korean doppelganger is a real danger, yet almost a joke that only two narcissistically bombastic cretins have the power to endanger all human existence. Trump threatens fire and fury of gigastrophic intensity, and Twitter's talking is not the answer to their diametric belligerence. But Winston Churchill is famous for saying that it is much better to jaw, jaw, jaw than to war, war, war. Well, Labor Day is over, the silly season is gone, and schools across the United States are beginning the new school year this week. So it seems appropriate to read an essay by Howard Zinn, because his books, especially A People's History of the United States, published in 1980, have been removed from all schools in Arkansas, and his teachings are forbidden by state law, thanks to the state legislature, which, probably to no one's surprise, is majority Republican. Before he became a world-renowned teacher and progressive historian and activist, Howard Zinn served in Europe during World War II as a U.S. Army Air Force bombardier in the B-17. After the war, he returned his war medals to the Army with a note, "Never again." He was born in August 1922 and died at age 87 in January 2010. His parents were Jewish immigrants. And now, The Coming Revolt of the Guards by Howard Zinn. All those histories of this country centered on the Founding Fathers and the Presidents weigh oppressively on the capacity of the ordinary citizen to act, so tremblingly respectful of states and statesmen, and so disrespectful by inattention to people's movements that we need some counterforce to avoid being crushed into submission. They suggest that in times of crises we must look to someone to save us. In the Revolutionary crisis, the Founding Fathers. In the slavery crisis, Abraham Lincoln. In the Depression, Franklin Roosevelt. In the post-Vietnam Watergate crisis, Jimmy Carter. And that between occasional crises, everything is all right, and it is sufficient for us to be restored to that normal state. They teach us that the supreme act of citizenship is to choose among saviors by going into a voting booth every 4 years to choose between two white and well-off Anglo-Saxon males of inoffensive personality and orthodox opinions. The idea of saviors has been built into the entire culture beyond politics. We have learned to look to stars, leaders, experts in every field, thus surrendering our own strength, demeaning our own ability, obliterating our own selves. But from time to time, Americans reject that ideal and rebel. These rebellions so far have been contained. The American system is the most ingenious system of control in world history. With a country so rich in natural resources, talent, and labor power, the system can afford to distribute just enough wealth to just enough people to limit discontents to a troublesome minority. It is a country so powerful, so big, so pleasing to so many of its citizens that it can afford to give freedom of dissent to the small number who are not pleased. There is no system of control with more openings, apertures, leeways, flexibilities, rewards for the chosen, winning tickets in lotteries. There is none that disperses its controls more complexly through the voting system, the work situation, the church, the family, the school, the mass media. None more successful in mollifying opposition with reforms, isolating people from one another, creating patriotic loyalty. 1% of the nation owns a third of the wealth. The rest of the wealth is distributed in such a way as to turn those in 99% against one another. Small property owners against the property lusts, black against white, native-born against foreign-born, intellectuals and professionals against the uneducated and unskilled. These groups have resented one another and warred against one another with such vehemence and violence as to obscure their common position as sharers of leftovers in a very wealthy country. Against the reality of that desperate, bitter battle for resources made scarce by elite control, I am taking the liberty of uniting those 99% as the people. I have been writing a history that attempts to represent their submerged, deflected, common interest, a people's history of the United States. To emphasize the commonality of the 99%, to declare deep enmity of the interest with the 1%, is to do exactly what the governments of the United States and the wealthy elite allied to them, from the founding fathers to now, have tried their best to prevent. James Madison feared a majority faction, and that's a quote, and hoped the new Constitution would control it. He and his colleagues began the Constitution with the words, "We the people," pretending that the new government stood for everyone, and hoping that this myth, accepted as fact, would endure domestic tranquility. And that the pretense continued over the generations, helped by all embracing symbols, physical or verbal, the flag, patriotism, democracy, national interest, national defense, national security. The slogans were dug into the earth of American culture like a circle of covered wagons on the western plain, from inside which the white, slightly privileged American could shoot to kill the enemy outside, Indians or blacks or foreigners or other whites too wretched to be allowed inside the circle. The managers of the caravan watched at a safe distance, and when the battle was over and the field strewn with dead on both sides, they would take over the land and prepare another expedition for another territory. The scheme never worked perfectly. The revolution and the Constitution, trying to bring stability by containing the class angers of the colonial period while enslaving blacks, annihilating or displacing Indians, did not quite succeed, judging by the tenant uprisings, the slave revolts, the abolitionist agitation, the feminist upsurge, the Indian guerrilla warfare of the pre-Civil War years. After the Civil War, a new coalition of Southern and Northern elites developed, with Southern whites and blacks of the lower classes occupied in racial conflict, Native workers and immigrant workers clashing in the North, and the farmers dispersed over a big country, while the system of capitalism consolidated itself in industry and government. But there came rebellion among industrial workers and a great opposition movement among farmers. At the turn of the 20th century, the violent pacification of blacks and Indians and the use of elections and war to absorb and divert white rebels were not enough in the conditions of modern industry to prevent the great upsurge of socialism, the massive labor struggles before the First World War. Neither the war nor the partial prosperity of the 1920s nor the apparent destruction of the socialist movement could prevent, in the situation of economic crises, another radical awakening, another labor upsurge in the 1930s. World War II created a new unity, followed by an apparently successful attempt in the atmosphere of the Cold War to extinguish the strong radical temper of the war years. But then, surprisingly, came the surge of the 1960s from people thought long subdued or put out of sight, blacks, women, Native Americans, prisoners, soldiers, and a new radicalism, which threatened to spread widely in a population disillusioned by the Vietnam War and the policies and the politics of Watergate. The exile of Richard Nixon, the celebration of the bicentennial, the presidency of Jimmy Carter, all aimed at restoration. But though the great tide of the 60s had receded, it left on the beach millions of moving organisms, pockets of energy, in an atmosphere calmed down but electric with possibility. In the uncertain solution of the 1970s, going into the 80s, it was very important for the establishment, that uneasy club of business executives, generals, and politicos, to maintain the historic pretension of national unity, in which the government represents all the people and the common enemy is overseas, not at home, where disasters of economics or war are unfortunate errors or tragic accidents to be corrected by the members of the same club that brought the disasters. It is important also to make sure this artificial unity of highly privileged and slightly privileged is the only unity, that the 99% remain split in countless ways and turn against one another to vent their angers. But with all the controls of power and punishment, enticements and concessions, diversions and decoys operating throughout the history of the country, the establishment has been unable to keep itself secure from revolt. Every time it looked as if it had succeeded, the very people it thought seduced or subdued stirred and rose. Blacks, cajoled by Supreme Court decisions and congressional statutes, rebelled. Women, wooed and ignored, romanticized and mistreated, rebelled. Indians, thought dead, reappeared defiant. young people, despite lures of career and comfort, defected. Working people, thought soothed by reforms, regulated by law, kept within bounds by their own unions, went on strike. Government intellectuals, pledged to secrecy, began giving away secrets. Priests turned from piety to protest. Prisoners, isolated in cages, organized. To recall this is to remind people of what the establishment would like them to forget. The enormous capacity of apparently helpless people to resist, of apparently contented people to demand change. To uncover such history is to find a powerful human impulse to assert one's humanity. It is to hold out, even in times of deep pessimism, the possibility of surprise. True, to overstate class consciousness, to exaggerate rebellion and its successes would be misleading. It would not account for the fact that the world, not just the United States, but everywhere else, is still in the hands of the elites. That people's movements, although they show an infinite capacity for recurrence, have so far been defeated or absorbed or perverted. That socialist revolutionists have betrayed socialism. The nationalist revolutions have led to new dictatorships. But most histories understate revolt, overemphasize statesmanship, and thus encourage impotency among citizens. When we look closely at resistance movements or even at isolated forms of rebellion, we discover that class consciousness or any other awareness of injustice has multiple levels. It has many ways of expression, many ways of revealing itself, open, subtle, direct, distorted. In a system of intimidation and control, people do not show how much they know, how deeply they feel, until their practical sense informs them that they can do so without being destroyed. History, which keeps alive the memories of people's resistance, suggests new definitions of power. By traditional definitions, whoever possesses military strength, wealth, command of official ideology, culture, control, has power. Measured by these standards, popular rebellion never looks strong enough to survive. However, the unexpected victories, even temporary ones, of insurgents show the vulnerability of the supposedly powerful. In a highly developed society, the establishment cannot survive without the obedience and loyalty of millions of people who are given small rewards to keep the system going. The soldiers and police, teachers and ministers, social workers and administrators, technicians and production workers, doctors, lawyers, nurses, transport and communications workers, garbage men and firemen. These people, the employed, the somewhat privileged, are drawn into alliance with the elite. They become the guards of the system, buffers between the upper and lower classes. If they stop obeying, the system falls. That will happen, I think, only when all of us who are slightly privileged and slightly uneasy begin to see that we are like the guards in the prison uprising at Attica, expendable, that the establishment, whatever rewards it gives us, will also, if necessary to maintain its control, kill us. Certain new facts may, in our time, emerge so clearly as to lead to general withdrawal of loyalty from the system. The new conditions of technology, economics, and war in the atomic age make it less and less possible for the guards of the system, the intellectuals, the homeowners, the taxpayers, the skilled workers, the professionals, the servants of government, to remain immune from the violence, physical and psychic, inflicted on the black, the poor, the criminal, the enemy overseas. There is evidence of growing dissatisfaction among the guards. It has been shown in the early 1960s that the poor and ignored were the non-voters, alienated from a political system they felt didn't care about them, and about which they could do little. In the mid-70s, a study found that alienation had spread upward into families above the poverty line. These were white workers, neither rich nor poor, but angry over economic insecurity, unhappy with their work, worried about their neighborhoods, hostile to government, combining elements of racism with elements of class consciousness, contempt for the lower classes along with distrust for the elite, and thus open to solutions from any direction, right or left. Let us imagine the prospect, for the first time in the nation's history, of a population united for fundamental change. Would the elite turn, as so often before, to its ultimate weapon, foreign intervention to unite the establishment in war. Here, too, the situation may be different today. The defeat of the colossal United States military machine in Vietnam was a turning point. The American empire may have reached its limits and must now retreat, recognizing that human beings abroad, if determined enough to rebel against harsh regimes, cannot be defeated even with the most terrible of weapons. Ordinary weapons may not be enough, and nuclear weapons too much, to deal with popular revolutions, and Americans may no longer go along with military intervention. With the establishment's inability either to solve severe economic problems at home or to manufacture abroad a safety valve for domestic discontent, Americans might be ready to demand not just more tinkering, more reform laws, another reshuffling of the same deck, another New Deal, but radical change. Let us be utopian for a moment so that when we get realistic again, it is not that realism so useful to the establishment in its discouragement of action. That realism anchored to a certain kind of history empty of surprise. Let us imagine what radical change would require of us all. The society's levers of power would have to be taken away from those whose drives have led to the present state, the giant corporations, the military, and their politician collaborators. We would need, by a coordinated effort of local groups all over the country, to reconstruct the economy for both efficiency and justice, producing in a cooperative way what people need most. We would start on our neighborhoods, our cities, our workplaces. Work of some kind would be needed by everyone, including people now kept out of the workforce, children, old people, handicapped people. Society could use the enormous energy now idle, the skills and talents now unused. Everyone could share the routine but necessary jobs for a few hours a day and leave most of the time free for enjoyment, creativity, labors of love, and yet produce enough for an equal and ample distribution of goods. Certain basic things would be abundant enough to be taken out of the money system and be available, free, for everyone. Food, housing, health care, education, transportation. The great problem would be to work out a way of accomplishing this without a centralized bureaucracy, using not the incentives of prison and punishment, but those incentives of cooperation which spring from natural human desires, which in the past have been used by the state in times of war, but also by social movements that gave hints of how people might behave in different conditions. Decisions would be made by small groups of people in their workplaces, their neighborhoods, a network of cooperatives in communication with one another, a neighborly socialism avoiding the class hierarchies of capitalism and the harsh dictatorships that have taken the name socialist. To do all that in the complex conditions of control in the United States would require combining the energy of all previous movements in American history, of labor insurgents, black rebels, Native Americans, women, young people, along with the new energy of an angry middle class. People would need to begin to transform their immediate environments, the workplace, the family, the school, the community, by a series of struggles against absentee authority to give control of these places to the people who live and work there. These struggles would involve all the tactics used at various times in the past by people's movements, demonstrations, marches, civil disobedience, strike and boycotts and general strikes, direct action to redistribute wealth, to reconstruct institutions, to revamp relationships, creating in music, literature, drama, all the arts and all the areas of work and play in everyday life, a new culture of sharing, of respect, a new joy and collaboration of people to help themselves and one another. There would be many defeats. But when such a movement took hold in hundreds of thousands of places all over the country, it would be impossible to suppress, because the very guards the system depends on to crush such a movement would be among the rebels. It would be a new kind of revolution, the only kind that could happen, I believe, in a country like the United States. It would take enormous energy, sacrifice, commitment, patience. But because it would be a process over time, starting without delay, there would be the immediate satisfaction that people have always found in the affectionate ties of groups striving together for a common goal. All this takes us far from American history, into the realm of imagination, but not totally removed from history. There are at least glimpses in the past of such a possibility. in the 1960s and 70s. For the first time, the establishment failed to produce national unity and patriotic fervor in a war. There was a flood of cultural changes such as the country had never seen in sex, family, personal relations, exactly those situations most difficult to control from the ordinary centers of power. And never before was there such a general withdrawal of confidence from so many elements of the political and economic system. In every period of history, people have found ways to help one another, even in the midst of a culture of competition and violence, if only for brief periods, to find joy in work, struggle, companionship, nature. The prospect is for times of turmoil, struggle, but also inspiration. There is a chance that such a movement could succeed in doing what the system itself has never done, bring about great change with little violence. This is possible because the more than 99% that begin to see themselves as sharing needs, the more the guards and the prisoners see their common interests, the more the establishment becomes isolated, ineffectual. The elite's weapons, money, control of information would be useless in the face of a determined population. The servants of the system would refuse to work to continue the old deadly order and would begin using their time, their space, the very things given them by the system to keep them quiet, to dismantle that system while creating a new one. The prisoners of the system will continue to rebel, as before, in ways that cannot be foreseen, at times that cannot be predicted. The new fact of our era is the chance that they may be joined by the guards. We readers and writers of books have been, for the most part, among the guards. If we understand that and act on it, not only will life be more satisfying right off, but our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, might possibly see a different and marvelous world. And that was Howard Zinn, The Coming Revolt of the Guards, and something else he wrote about his book. As for the title of my book, A People's History of the United States, it is not quite accurate. A people's history promises more than any one person can fulfill, and it is the most difficult kind of history to recapture. I call it that anyway because, with all its limitations, it is a history disrespectful of governments and respectful of people's movements of resistance. The book is based on 20 years of teaching and research in American history and as many years of involvement in social movements. But it could not have been written without the work of several generations of scholars, and especially the current generation of historians, who have done immense work in the history of blacks, Indians, women, and working people of all kinds. And it could not have been written without the work of many people, not professional historians, who were stimulated by the social struggles around them to put together material about the lives and activities of ordinary people trying to make a better world or just trying to survive. Our nation had gone through an awful lot, the Vietnam War, civil rights, Watergate, yet the textbooks offered the same fundamental nationalist glorification of the country. I got the sense that people were hungry for a different, more honest take. It is not an unbiased account if you look at history from the perspective of the slaughtered and mutilated. It's a different story. And that was Howard Zinn. And to close off, this is Michael McCusker, and I end this program with a tribute to Ronald L. Pierce, who was shot and killed 51 years ago today, September 7th, 1966, in a small Vietnamese village near the South China Sea. The village and another village nearby were ravaged in revenge. Pierce resembled the movie actor Robert Mitchum in appearance as well as attitude. I think of a movie in which Mitchum played a World War II U.S. Marine trapped on a Japanese-held Pacific island with a nun. Heaven knows Mr. Allison. Pierce was a Vietnam War Marine and was never associated with heaven, but he had the face of Christ in thorns tattooed over his entire back with never a good reason why except that he was drunk. I don't know what Pierce's opinion of the war might have become had he lived. He really didn't have much time to think about it, although he was certainly critical of it, of its threat to his future. He might have said, as did Howard Zinn, never again.